This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Anthony Brooks. And we return now to more coverage of the fiscal cliff.
Ha! Just kidding. Actually, right now we're going to turn to something completely different, but perhaps even more dramatic. Opera. Yes, opera.
Wabbit twat. Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit.
Kill the wabbit.
Okay, so this is, of course, Warner Brothers' classic 1957 cartoon short, What's Opera, Doc? Brilliant, even today. And I'll admit, when I was a kid, this was my first introduction to the world of opera.
Meghna, Elmer Fudd was your first introduction to opera.
Yes, and it was awesome.
All right, Elmer and Bugs Bunny are everything that opera today is not. They're irreverent, they're funny, they're raucous. But as different as they may seem from the modern-day idea of opera, Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny may actually be more true to opera's origins than anything seen in opera houses today, whether you're in Boston or Milan.
And therein may lie opera's salvation, according to our next guest. In fact, opera may need to kill the wabbit. We'll explain, so bear with me. Our guest is Carolyn Abate. She's a music professor at Harvard University and co-author of the wonderful new book, A History of Opera. Carolyn Abate, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
A real pleasure to have you. Absolutely the kind of conversation I was craving for now with all this talk about the fiscal cliff to sort of remind us and re-inject our conversation with some of the richness of life is what's called for. So let's do it. What do you think it is, first and foremost, that makes opera an art form that people get so passionate about?
Well, it has to do with the voice, the human singing voice. If you played operas on the piano without the voices, I don't think anyone would come to hear them. And voices are very hard to talk about because voices aren't notated in a score. They're just something that you can hear. Opera buffs love to talk about their favorite singers, but it's really hard to find a language to talk about what a voice is. And yet, that's what brings us to opera. It's the sound of these voices raised in these particular kinds of songs.
And there's the power and the passion and the drama of hearing an actual human being deliver that. But I also want to reach back into your past a little and ask you, was it that human voice that drew you to dedicate so much of your career to the study of this form of music? Because I understand that as an undergrad, you were supposed to end up being a biologist.
Well, that's absolutely true. I was majoring in molecular biology. I was a pianist, and so my musical background was really focused on piano repertory. And before age 17 or 18, I really had heard very little opera. And when I was an undergraduate, second year, I took a course that focused largely on 19th century operas. And I never looked back from there. I was so completely overwhelmed by the sounds of these pieces, by what they represented, by the particular kind of voices that I heard. And that really deflected my life's course in a significant way. And opera is what I ended up doing.
It's incredible because it must have truly reached into your soul to draw you away from a study of the human genome, for example.
I think that's very true. And it may also be the case that something like opera is really there. It's really material. It hears you. It has an effect on you. You hear it. It has an effect on you. Mm-hmm. It's a very, in certain ways, it's a very unacademic field.
Well, so let's go back a bit and trace a little bit of the history of opera that you write about in your new book. One of the things I found, you know, quite eye-opening was that you tell us that our current conception of what it means to experience opera is not at all like it was when this art form first began. So tell us, what were operas like when they were first invented in Italy, in Florence?
Well, this is where the raucousness and the rowdiness that's represented by Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd actually comes back into the discussion about opera. When opera began, roughly in the first decade of the 17th century. At that point, it still was a kind of exalted form. The first operas were performed in very, very small spaces for very, very small audiences. But very shortly thereafter, public theaters began to perform opera. And these performances were extremely chaotic. We know that there was a lot of noise in the theater. We know that for a long stretch of opera's history, the audience was not primarily focused on what was going on in the stage.
What were they focused on?
Well, they were in boxes. They were gambling. They were playing chess. They were eating. They were talking to their friends. There were shuttered boxes where God knows what was happening behind those shutters. And in a sense, what happened was that opera had to start to compete with this noise, and that changed its style. Operatic singing got more virtuosic. It got more forceful. The pieces got more brilliant. And so one way of seeing the early evolution of opera is that the producers, composers, and the singers started almost having to assert themselves against this chaotic and wonderful situation.
Oh, that is so fascinating. It's amazing because, I mean, I've always thought that the larger than life, you know, aspect that we think about is at the core of the operatic experience was there from the beginning. But it's just completely wonderful to hear that it's as a result of trying to get the audience's attention.
Well, no, and also we have to be very down to earth about this. The kind of reverent attention that we bring to opera and to theater, too, nowadays, we sit in the dark, we pay attention, we're really not allowed to talk or make noise. We can't go out. If we go out, we're not let back in. That is a very new phenomenon. That's really something that got started in the later 19th century. Yeah. Opera for a long time was a social occasion. And there was a lot of interaction between the audience and the singers. Singers encored pieces. We know of cases where a singer would be singing an aria about generosity, and a cardinal who happened to be sitting in a box leaned over and handed a sort of little pile of gold coins to the singer. So that there's not as much of a barrier between, say, the audience and what's going on on stage in this rowdier world.
Well, I am speaking with Carolyn Abate. She's a professor of music at Harvard University and co-author of the new book, The History of Opera, in which she says, she writes that opera today is something of a wonderful mortuary in comparison to what it was when the art form first began. So listeners, what do you think? Do you think opera is too reverential, too hushed now in comparison to what the raucousness that you're hearing Carolyn Abate describe? Or do you think that opera is as vibrant and vital as ever? What do you love about this art form that you don't find elsewhere? Or if you are an opera lover but worry about its future, how would you give it a 21st century shot in the arm? And this question is especially important for Boston because not that long ago, we were a two opera company town. Can we do it again here in Boston? How do we make new opera come alive? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So we can't talk about opera without hearing a little bit of it. And let's hear one of the classics.
Let's do it.
This is Mozart's Don Giovanni, sung, of course, by the great Pavarotti. So, Carolyn, this is one of the classics that's in every great company's repertoire. It's performed all the time. How was Don Giovanni first received when it was first performed?
Well, Don Giovanni actually was a success. It was first done in Prague, and then it was repeated the year after in Vienna. And in the 18th century, it's not that usual to have pieces repeat. There wasn't anything like what we understand as repertory. So pieces were written for one season. If they were really lucky, they might be done again. But it was assumed that they were ephemeral, that new pieces would replace them. And so all the resources and the especially economic resources in the 18th century that went into opera production went into constant commissioning of new pieces. And what's happened over, 200 years or so, more than 200 years at this point, is that gradually the balance shifted. Opera production became more and more a matter of producing older pieces, reviving pieces that already had been written. In the 1820s, Mozart was being played, and that was really unusual. That now was old opera. It was opera that was more than 30 years old. And the situation we have now is that overwhelmingly opera production is dedicated to performing older works. It's dedicated to the repertory and not to commissioning new pieces. So we've come sort of at 180 degrees from the situation that existed in the 18th century, where new pieces were flowing out of every opera house in immense numbers every year.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about one of the people who was one of the forces behind this change that you're describing about, how pieces weren't commissioned and the very nature of the relationship that opera goers would or should have to the performance going on in front of them. And that person is Wagner. So let's listen to one of his greats, and this is Das Rheingold. So, Carolyn Abate, what is it that Wagner did that had such a profound impact on how we experience opera?
Well, Wagner, of course, people will be taking up their swords. He's a controversial figure. But there are two things. Wagner was a revolutionary in operatic terms, and the revolution had two parts. And one part is that Wagner insisted that the audience lose itself in this magical world that was on the stage. He did not want opera to be a social occasion. He wanted the audience to be fully drawn into the fantasy that he was putting up there for them. And he did this in many ways. In his own theater in Bayreuth, he insisted, and really this is for the first time in history with few exceptions, he insisted that the auditorium be dark so that people couldn't read and couldn't see their neighbors. And the only thing there was to look at was that glittering world on the stage. Also in Bayreuth, and this is quite unique, he put the whole orchestra under the stage so that you weren't even distracted by looking at orchestral players. You were encouraged as much as possible to believe that what you were seeing was a kind of alternate reality.
Well, Carolyn, I mean, I can understand how in Wagner's time he wanted opera to be this exalted artistic experience.
Absolutely.
But isn't that exactly one of the things that makes people in 2013 now say, shake their heads and say, oh, it's that preciousness. It's that abstraction. It's that holier-than-thou sense of going to the opera house that makes people constantly wonder, does the art form have, a healthy future?
Well, look, what has happened, it's a really good point. What's happened is that is sort of Wagner's way of understanding theater became widely accepted. So now we take it as normal that this is what we do. And what happens is that when opera companies perform works that weren't written to bear that kind of constant attention, there can be a kind of mismatch between the reverence that we're supposed to bring and the quiet and the attentiveness and what the piece is actually doing. So I would, in certain ways, be happy if opera companies could manage a looser, more nimble, more freer experience of opera. And I'll tell you one place that this did happen and does happen. The New York Philharmonic has been doing concert performances of opera, sort of half-staged, and the orchestra is actually up in the back part of the stage, and the singers are in the front, but they're also coming out into the audience on ramps and in the aisles. The lights are up in the auditorium. You've got a libretto, which you can look at if you want to. You can bring your water in and drink it.
No.
Something that's forbidden in opera. And the level of enjoyment that the audience is experiencing at these performances is significant. And also the audience at those performances is younger.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting to me.
Well, Carolyn Abate, stand by, because we've got several people who want to have their say in this conversation about opera. Paul Zink, for example, sent us this tweet. For starters, the music world should include rock opera as legitimate. The magic flute was the Tommy of its day. And Y2000K sends us this tweet. It's the best of all live performances, a combo of singing, acting, choreography, directing, sets, costumes, music, the whole thing. Let's take a call from Stoughton, where Katie's calling. You're on the air, Katie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to bring it back to the music of opera. I speak to a lot of people about it who say that they can't even take it. It sounds like nails on a chalkboard. They have no interest, and it's hard for me to convince them otherwise. And I was wondering if there's some explanation for this deep-seated hatred of the music.
Katie, thank you so much for your call. Carolyn, do you have a brief answer to that?
Well, look, opera is something which it's a polarizer. You either love it or loathe it, I think. My own children are in the loathe camp. But I would say one thing, that a lot of people who hate opera have been listening to it as snippets, and often as recordings, and sometimes now as, you know, MP3 files. And that's a real distortion of the acoustic of opera. So this yes, it's grating, it's too loud. Often that comes from the fact that it's being mediated by technology. What I would say is, you know, drag that friend to an actual opera where you can hear the voices unamplified. No one ever uses microphones. It's considered shameful. And you'll have a very different sense of the sensuality of the voices and the pleasure that you can get from them.
Well, I want to take one quick call about how we experience opera today. And Fred is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Fred.
Well, thank you very much for taking your call. I'll be very brief because I know time is short. I was Sarah Caldwell. I was experienced with years ago when she was in Boston.
A former opera director, yes.
Yeah,
right.
She actually had some opera friends of hers come to one of friends of our house and just put a mini opera on in their living room, which was terrific. And then I was experienced when I was in high school in Connecticut. A group of us did a little study on Il Trovatore and went down to New York to see a rehearsal of the Met with Beverly Sills, which was fabulous. And I think that any opera, as the previous caller said, we need to be studied before you go, so at least you understand, listen to the music, and know what's going on. Especially if it's sung in a different language. But I've been a fan of opera for many years, and you just have to study it before you go so you know the history and know the story.
Fred, thank you so much for your call. And I'm glad you mentioned Sarah Caldwell, because that brings us back here to, I think, one of the unique positions that Boston finds itself as a city regarding opera. Because, again, it wasn't that long ago, just a year and a half ago, that we had two opera companies here, one of which was trying to do some very creative things in terms of newer shows, shorter runs, you know, maybe single-night performances even, to get that nimble back, Carolyn Abate, that you were talking about earlier, that was a hallmark of, you know, opera several centuries ago. It didn't quite work out. That doesn't mean that it can't, you know, going forward in Boston. But isn't that exactly the direction that you think, you know, this art form needs to go to loosen the tie a little bit?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. One thing that I would hope for is that you know, commissions for new operas continue, but they don't necessarily have to be grand operas. They don't necessarily have to be works that involve huge numbers of voices, highly trained operatic voices, massive choruses, and massive orchestra. You have to realize that if that's the tool that you put in a composer's hands, that the tool itself is going to influence the way he or she is going to write an opera. So chamber opera, indeed, can be a lot more nimble than grand opera. There also, and this is something I'm very interested in, I think the word opera can either be very limited or very large. There's been we have a long history,
right,
in the Western world of, and indeed all over the world, of pieces that are written for voices with music in theater. And I think
one of those words is Broadway in the United States.
And all of these things. And the truth is, if I try to think of this really marvelous experiences of new music in theater, I often now think of incidental music and incidental singing that's written for plays and for performances of spoken plays, where the music seems to sort of arise out of the situation. Singing can float in. There's instrumental sound effects. There's dramatic music. A lot of people would say, well, that's not opera. And yet sometimes when I hear it, I think, that's as good as Puccini.
Well, on that note, Carol, I'm sorry, Carolyn, finish your thought.
Throw the definition open. Write things that maybe some other people wouldn't think are operas, and restore some of that raucousness.
Great. Well, on that note, I have to say how much I've enjoyed the raucousness and respectfulness of this conversation. Carolyn Abate is a professor of music at Harvard University and co-author of The History of Opera. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Poor widow Bonnie. Poor widow Bonnie.